Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 31 for December 4th, 2010. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me as always. This episode is all about music in games, and it's a show I've wanted to do for a long time. As I'll discuss in the segment, it seems to me this year has been an especially good one for game music across the board in both AAA titles and in indie games. Of course, music has always played a big role in games, and it surprises me how little we've actually focused on it as critics and reviewers. So, in this episode, I've invited a couple of musicians, who also happen to be excellent game critics, to join me for a conversation about some of our favorite music, new and old, composed specifically for games. And I think our timing couldn't possibly be better. The day after I recorded this interview, we learned that composer Christopher Tin received a Grammy Award nomination for his work on Civilization IV's opening theme. It's the first time a video game song has ever been nominated for a Grammy. To which I say, it's about time, don't you think? So, my guests for this show are Kirk Hamilton and Dan Bruno, both of whom I properly introduce in the segment. I also want to encourage you to stay tuned for my annual Favorite Games of the Year shows, which will appear later this month and feature many of the people that you've heard here over the last few years. So, I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks very much for listening, and away we go. Strap in for a musical joyride as I'm joined by two guests who are here to talk about music in games with plenty of clips to highlight our conversation. I love discussing music in games. I've written about the subject on many occasions on my blog, but I don't have the musical chops to go as deep as I'd like to. Both of my guests do. My first guest returning for his second visit to the show is Kirk Hamilton. Kirk is a writer and a composer, a singer, a jazz teacher. You play the saxophone too, right, Kirk?
Yeah, that's my main instrument.
That's your instrument. He also is a writer, of course, and he writes. He's a freelancer and he writes for places like Paste and most recently Joystick, which is really cool.
Yeah.
You've written for acoustic guitar, I found out.
Yeah, I did. I wrote some instructional articles for them. That's been fun.
And you're also the editor over at Gamer Melodico, which is a great website. We'll link to it, and everyone should go there and check out your work. So welcome, Kirk. It's great to have you back.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great to be back. Thank you, Michael.
And my second guest is Dan Bruno. Dan writes about games and often music in games for his website, Cruz Elroy, and his blog, danbruno.net. He's got a series of terrific posts in which he carefully analyzes the music of Mother 3 and Ocarina of Time, a couple of other things he's done in that direction. And he was a co-founder of the Vintage Game Club with me and David Carlton. And Dan also happens to work for a little software company in Boston called Harmonix. I have to tell you, I have a student in my seminar writing his term paper on Rock Band 3, on the evolution of the Rock Band series.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So, which really essentially meant that he was able to wangle a copy of a Rock Band 3, you know, paid for by the college out of me. So, yeah.
Did he get all the hardware as well?
He got a keyboard.
All right. Yeah.
But I get to keep it. So he gets to use it, but I get to keep it. So anyway, welcome, Dan. It's great to have you with me on the show, and it's great to have you talking about music.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, what I did was I asked my two guests to think about music that they found interesting in games, and we aren't going to limit ourselves necessarily to games that have come out recently. We'll sort of reach back, I think, to some older games as well. But, you know, this all began by a series of conversations that kind of started to happen around Twitter and various other places, and where we all just started to realize that we were really kind of into a lot of the music that was coming out related to games. There's just been a lot of games this year with terrific music. Games like Red Dead Redemption, you know, a pretty magnificent score there in that game, I think, and Bioshock 2. And I mean, right now I'm playing Epic Mickey, and it's got a delightful score. And Kirby's Epic Yarn, which I'll talk about later, and I've written about. And, you know, these are all games that came out really essentially within months of each other here in 2010. So it occurred to me, you know, find a couple of people who know more than me about music and games, and let's talk about it. And Dan and Kirk were gracious enough to join me. And so what we're going to do here is we're going to kind of pass the ball around, and we're going to start with Kirk. And basically, we're just going to throw a piece of music into the conversation and talk a little bit about why we like it and how it serves the game that it's written for, and, you know, why we chose it and why it matters to us, if that makes sense. So you guys ready to roll?
Ready.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So Kirk, why don't you lead us off and throw a piece of music our way?
All right. Well, you actually already talked about the game that I'd like to talk about first. It is a recent game, Red Dead Redemption, that came out this year. I think this game probably has my favorite soundtrack of the year. That's a hard thing to say. It's one of the most effective pieces of game music I've heard in a long time. Partly, mainly really for me, because of how it integrates with the soundscape. So I picked a clip here that we can listen to that sort of shows the music and the ambient sound of the game coming together.
Great.
So listen to that.
We'll cue that up. This is from Red Dead Redemption, and this piece is called Shootout.
Was that you getting shot there, Kirk, at the end?
yeah, that was me dying. So it's called Shootout. It's really should just be called like Shot. but yeah, so that clip kind of illustrates a whole lot of things that Red Dead Redemption does really well. Part of it, and hopefully the listeners that are listening to this on headphones can really hear this, there's a lot of space at the beginning of that clip, because really the way I hear it in this score, this is by Bill Elm and Woody Jackson. They wrote the music. But I feel like there's a synergy going on between their compositions and the work of the sound designers. And I should disclose here that a really good friend of mine from school actually was one of the two sound engineers on this game. So I'm not really that biased or unbiased about it, I should say. but still, I think it speaks for itself. There's this, you know, you can hear this kind of, I think it's a dobro or something ringing out at the very beginning of the clip. And then it's just silent, and you can kind of hear the, you know, the crickets, and then there's a little bird, and then you hear someone off in the distance, and the music starts to layer. And the whole thing is, it's kind of a bunch of small points being tied together into a larger tapestry. So if you listen to the sound of the game, that's going on to begin with. You know, there's the crickets going and a bird, and maybe you'll hear a guy way off in the distance, or you hear a bell or a train. The wind and all of these things. And then also the soundtrack is made up in large part of a bunch of disparate parts that come together. You know, there's this little piano note that'll play, or maybe a trumpet trill or a guitar chord. And then when stuff starts to happen, like you heard, they saw me, I had a bounty on my head. So suddenly these guys start riding at me, and you hear them coming, and the music starts to layer. And it's actually not new music that comes in. It's the same music that plays at first, anyways. It's the same music that plays when you're just wandering around. But then it layers on top of itself, and it gets more and more tense, and then the bass comes in, and then you hear it start to build, and then you hear me die. And actually, this game has like one of the best dead screens of any game I've ever played. It just, you're dead. And the whole thing actually kind of comes to a head. I think it's just a brilliantly made score, just in how it uses the sound effects like musical instruments. You'll hear a shaker, but then you'll hear a rattlesnake, and they all come together, and it's just so seamless. I couldn't believe it. I could just sit and listen to this game on headphones without even playing. So,
I wonder, when I first heard little clips of it before I had the game in my hands, I think I probably just looked at a couple of previews that had been posted early. My first impression was, oh my God, it's like a Morricone, derivative spaghetti Western score. You know, it's just going to sound like Fistful of Dollars. It's obviously inspired by that, but it really is its own thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree. They go in some really interesting directions. Without getting too theoretical, a lot of the harmony that they're using is from a scale called the harmonic minor scale. And that's not typically used in like Westerns. You know, you don't hear a whole lot of that. Sometimes you do. But a lot of the harmony, it's more modern, especially as you get towards the end of the game when you're really starting to butt up against the modern age, you know. And it works thematically even. And there's some kind of actually out of place jazzy stuff when you're down in Mexico. Some of the trumpet riffs get a little bit too like Miles Davis-ish. It really stands on its own, and it's not, yeah, it could have really easily just been. And I would imagine there are plenty of other Western games out there that just sort of have a knockoff, like Good, the Bad, and the Ugly thing.
Yeah.
Where this, it's, you can hear the influence there, but it's not, you know, it's its own thing very much. Which, yeah, I respect that a lot.
You know, that last piece, the piece that's sung at the end, it just killed me, man. That piece just like was a knife through my heart.
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting moment in the game when it seemed a little, people had a lot to say about that. I heard both sides of it. I dug it, especially the first time that licensed music comes in when you go to Mexico and that Far From Home song.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really, it was a great moment for me. I thought it was really neat. I didn't see it coming at all.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, I mean, Rockstar, really, they're really good at using licensed music normally. So it seemed like it fit with the game, with their sort of aesthetic. So yeah, just killer soundtrack on that game.
Well, it struck me too, as you were talking about that, I was remembering playing it. I hadn't thought about this for a while, the way that the game trains you to, when events get triggered, those triggers involve certain things happening, and those are accompanied by musical pieces that trigger then in you a sense of, oh my God, there's somebody chasing me, or I've walked into a bad situation, that you're actually conditioned over time in the game by the music.
Well, and by the sound, you know, it's funny. I just going through this game and really paying attention to the sound, and there are very few sound cues that aren't directly connected to something that's gameplay related. In the world, in the ambient, a lot of times in games where you're standing around in a field or something and you can hear all this stuff happening, but it's just canned. It's just like they took a mic in a field and recorded. Where in this game, everything is tied to something. Like you hear a bird, but it's a bird that you can go hunt. You know, if you hear something moving through the brush, it's an actual thing that's really there. And I think that's really cool. Like it, it boggles my mind to think about the amount of work that must have gone into that game. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Damn you, Kirk. Now I got to play that game again. I really sunk a lot of time into that game, and I don't know. There's something about the world.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, and the Undead DLC for that game is awesome, too. I highly recommend it. Bill and Woody recorded new music for it and everything.
Oh, they did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. It's great. It's like the cast of the game decided to make a funny horror movie together. it's sweet. I really recommend it.
Okay. All right, Mr. Bruno, let's toss it over to you.
Well, I don't have anything nearly that ambience in my collection, but I guess the closest thing would be this piece I picked out of Earthbound, the old Super Nintendo RPG, which is actually a boss battle theme for Master Belch.
Yes. I'll cue that up, and let's take a listen.
So Earthbound is you know, one of my favorites, and the soundtrack is, you know, draws from a pretty incredible range of genres. There's, you know, the classical music and jazz and sort of Chuck Berry style rock and roll and blues and bluegrass, and then there's this sort of weird electronic thing that you just heard, which is a boss battle. Like usually when you think of boss battle musics in you know, RPGs or even, you know, action games like Zelda or something like that, you'll think of, you know, something sort of bombastic with, you know, lots of I don't want to be the theory guy, but lots of little chromatic runs and tritones and dissonances and something that just sounds sort of frightening and, you know, large and intimidating. And this is, you know, incredibly understated. If you were to just hear it out of context, you would probably not even associate it with a video game, let alone a boss battle in a video game. But in the context of what Earthbound does, I think it works really well. That little high-pitched sort of siren sound that you're hearing in that piece is, for whatever reason, a recurring motive in the entire game. It shows up in, you know, dungeon music. It shows up in other battles. It gets sort of, I don't want to say remixed, but they take the same sort of intervallic pattern and apply it in a bunch of different ways. You might have also caught there's a very small reference to the Super Mario Brothers theme in there, which I assume they just threw in for fun. But anyway, I thought that piece was interesting because it's an example of something that seems appropriate for the game that it's in, but doesn't seem characteristic of, you know, what game music usually does in that context. And I think that's sort of, you know, representative of what Earthbound does as a whole, where it draws on, you know, a lot of role-playing game mechanics. You know, you walk around, you have hit points, you have weapons that you upgrade, but, you know, you're this little kid with a baseball bat or a frying pan. It sort of plays on, you know, your expectations a little bit. And I guess that's a large part of the appeal of the game and the series for me. So I like that the music can tie into that as well.
You know, it's interesting to me that because it is the game is kind of a parody and a kind of a gentle satire, I suppose you could say, of the genre. I had a couple of students write about it some years ago, and they started digging into some of the targets of the parody, and they found a bunch of music stuff that I didn't even think about or didn't even know existed. Apparently, there's a little Monty Python in there. There's a Star Spangled Banner in the cafe. What else did they? I think there's like a Little Rascals song somewhere in there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know about that one.
Yeah. There's like The Who, Won't Get Fooled Again is in there somewhere.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, I mean, if you're paying attention, you can catch sort of like the references to other video games in the game. You get references to other pieces of music too, which is kind of cool.
Right. I did a post on my website doing this for Mother 3, the sequel to Earthbound, where I tried to basically pull out as many of the musical allusions as I could find. And then I got a lot of great help in the, you know, in the comments. So, oh, what about this piece? What about that piece? I guess it's just sort of a series trademark. Well, the series has gone as far as it's going to go, but these sort of real subtle allusions that they like to make. And I thought it was interesting listening to the Red Dead piece that Kirk brought us. Then when the music gets to that level of, you know, ambience, I'm not turned off by it, but it doesn't appeal to me in the same way that something like this does, because I think if anyone has, you know, seen my website before, they'll know that I really focus on, you know, harmonic analysis and sort of very traditional, like, oh, what's the structure of this song? How do, you know, whatever. Not, you know, how are they using sound so much as, you know, how are they using music theory?
That's one of the weird things about that game. I mean, it's not a melodic game. And I'm like a melody freak. Like, so many of my favorite game pieces they're my favorites because they're, you know, they're really melodic. And that game, yeah, it's like, it's very, it's a different kind of music almost. Like, it's this synergy of sound design and music. So yeah, exactly. It's really different than something from, like, you know, an older RPG and kind of a new thing for sure, because we really didn't have the processing power for that stuff before.
Oh, totally. I guess I'm thinking of, have you guys read, I know, Michael, you have read Extra Lives, Kirk, the Tom Whistle's book?
Oh, definitely.
I'm thinking of how he was mentioning how he likes games with stories because it sort of gives him something to latch onto and he can write about those. And even though he enjoys, you know, Geometry Wars or what have you, games that are less like that, a little bit more abstract, it's harder for him to sort of to write about, to like have something to I guess grapple with. He's used to writing about stories, and I guess I feel sort of a similar way about music, where it's not that I dislike, you know, a soundtrack like Red Dead Redemption or that approach, but it makes it harder for me to sort of dig into it in a way.
Well, don't shy away from the theory stuff, because, man, that's why I've got you guys here. So I think there are probably a fair number of people. Here. Well, you know, I think that this is, we don't get much of that. Let's be honest. I mean, I keep thinking there's going to be a dedicated website to digging into game music, and maybe it exists and I'm just not aware of it. But I think there's plenty to talk about in a more carefully analytical way than we typically do. But I rarely see it. So... Well, I think
there's definitely there's a thing where talking it's a different kind of language talking about a piece like a lot of the other pieces I've got actually that are just much more formal compositions, or they're almost like a pop tune even if they don't have lyrics. So they're easy to talk about because you can talk about them as a piece of music. The language required to talk about something like Red Dead Redemption or Flower or these games where there's this synthesis going on that you're kind of composing it as you play it. It changes. It's much more like talking about actually building an arrangement, like it's more of an arrangement compositional language and less analytical. So yeah, it's a different thing. That's starting to go on here.
I guess I'm too hyper focused on the analytical side of it. I think as you said, it's like a fusion of sound design and composition.
Yeah, it's trippy.
Well, I will take us to the next clip. Speaking of melodic, we were talking about that a minute ago. Let's listen to some Zelda Wind Waker, shall we?
All right.
This is the intro, actually, the section where the little backstory is told. It's called the hero theme. If you're a Zelda fan, of course, there's the themes that you're inevitably going to hear in those games are like little golden moments if they're handled well, and I think they typically are. And what I love about that piece is that it's literally the introduction to the game. You slide the disc in and, you know, you start the game, and it's like the music understands what the player wants. And that's to be kind of segued into the game and to reach that kind of familiar Zelda moment. And it just kind of slowly builds to it until you finally get that iconic theme song that we know so well. But the instrumentation is different than we've ever heard it. And with Wind Waker, I especially love the pan flutes and the ways that the game kind of embraces the seafaring narrative. And I guess I'm always interested in how franchises and games that exist over time with a fan base, how they have to deal with their iconicness, if you know what I mean. And like, if you've got this library of music that you're probably going to, the people are going to want to continue to hear, what do you do with it in a new format? Or how can you reorchestrate it? Or how can you make it more interesting and keep it up to date without making it feel like it's been rehashed? And I think what I love about Wind Waker is that it's sort of like they did with the visuals. They took the things we knew and they reformatted them in really inventive ways. And it sounds very fresh, but still familiar.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I love listening to a Zelda soundtrack and just picking out, you know, they've to varying degrees, they've either sort of buried the main themes, the familiar music, or they've, you know, brought it right to the forefront like they did just then. I remember playing Ocarina of Time, the main theme doesn't actually appear, which is very, very odd. You kind of expect it over and over again. And then in Twilight Princess, there are sort of snippets of it in the Hyrule Field music or whatever. But I don't think it's like sort of fully stated until the credits music. So it's, you know, they sort of play with you and they'll give you a little snippet, like, you know, the first few notes of the of that Wind Waker intro, and that little ascending pattern is, you know, it's modeled on the main Zelda theme, but you just sort of get it, you know, very quickly, and it has this entire, you know, sea shanty build up before it gives you the theme proper.
Yeah, I'm wondering what you guys think. I remember when you were posting about this a while back, Dan, and when I wrote about it a little bit on my blog, I got some conversation from people about whether or not the music would be improved if it was actually fully orchestrated. That what we're hearing in those older Nintendo games it's MIDI music, and it has a kind of a fake quality to it. It's trying to sound like this, but it's not sampled or anything. It's just a MIDI sound. And you know, some people think that's just right, given the nature of the game and the experience that the player's having. It's actually better that way than if it had been this big full orchestra. Did you have a feeling about that one way or the other?
It's kind of complicated, right? Like, I think the most interesting thing to me about game music is sort of the constraints that composers run up against. So one of them is when you have a long running series, as you were describing, and you need to figure out how to work in some of the, you know, the existing music so that the fans are happy, right? Like if you had a Zelda game that had an entirely new soundtrack, you know, everyone would hate that. They want to hear the music that they know. So that's a constraint that you have to work under. If you were making games, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you would have the constraint of the hardware where, you know, maybe you have to deal with, you know, FM synthesis or what have you to make sure that, you know, your stuff has to fit on the cartridge or the optical media, the early, you know, PlayStation or something like that. You can't have like a ton of music, or you can't have real music. Maybe you have to have synthesized music just to make it possible. That's sort of what I got at with the Ocarina of Time series, where within the context of the game, you know, Link has his ocarina, and the ocarina can only play five notes or whatever. I think it's five notes. You know, all of the little in-game songs have to use those same notes. So that was sort of exploring like, what are the you know, compositional implications of only being able to use these three pitches. I think it's sort of like a D minor triad plus one or two more notes. You know, they have to sort of compose around that to make it interesting.
Also, it's kind of a boon for a composer sometimes if you've, not just because you have pre-existing material to work with, I think even being able to just really get away with using such basic sounds. They're not even really advanced MIDI sounds, you know, but they sound so perfect for Zelda. They sound like Zelda because Zelda's been around for long enough that they just do. Where with a new game, they, you know, most likely couldn't get away with using something so simple. You know, most new games have these sort of full orchestral soundtracks, or at least really advanced recordings. So.
Right. But I think in a way that gets, like, the further that you get away from those restrictions of, you know, the type of sound that you can use, it can be less engaging in a way. Like if you can use your, you know, 100 piece orchestra, and your score ends up sounding a lot like a film score, say, I find that somehow less interesting.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I mean, that being constrained to just really, I mean, it's the melody, right? Like when you're constrained to just melody, if you've got a chip that can play three notes or something, one of those really has to be the melody, and you got to get really creative. It's definitely a strength for a writer. And right. I would think that somebody writing, even for a new Zelda game, it'd be nice to know, well, if I want to use the old sounds and the old themes, even if I don't use them for the whole game, I've got that to fall back on. I don't have to just completely create something new and sell it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to say, it's my favorite game, and I would love for it to get the Sly treatment, that the Sly collection recently. I don't know if you've seen it for the PS3, but they've, you know, basically HD'd it, and it just looks fantastic. I would love for Wind Waker to get that treatment, and I'd love for, you know, the music to get the full upgrade as well. I don't know why that appeals to me, but I think that it could really shine in that format. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, let's pass it back to you, Kirk, and why don't you take us to the next clip?
Cool. Well, actually, this next one will pick up a little bit from that, talking about modern bands using old school sounds. This is the soundtrack for a game that I actually haven't played yet, the Scott Pilgrim versus the World soundtrack by Anna Managuchi, which is super, super cool. So this is a song from what I'm guessing is the beginning of the game. It's called Another Winter. so I'm really into this soundtrack. And you know, I mean, I've seen enough of the game, I think, to get the gameplay. So it, part of what's cool about it actually is how it matches up with the game. But really, man, these guys, this is a band I wasn't really that familiar with until, earlier in the year. They were at PAX, and, just heard a lot of good things about them and about their soundtrack. So yeah, I decided to download it. There was like a deal on it on Amazon, and I got so into it. I mean, I put it on when I was cleaning my apartment, and I wound up like running around like I was like on speed. It was like the most, it's just like, it's like this extended fist pump of an album. Like it never lets down. It's just epic. And it's cool. I mean, it combines a lot of things. So this band, right, they're a full band, the rock band, but they play with like an NES on stage. That they use to get the like real old sounds. So you hear this kind of synthesis there, and then they run all their drums and guitars through filters. So everything kind of sounds like a chiptune, but it's not a chiptune. It's a rock band. And there's a lot that I like about these guys. There's a whole lot of stuff out there right now. There's a lot of, you know, bands that are sort of recreating vintage game music, or, you know, taking it out, or they're writing songs that are about games, that this kind of nerdcore thing. And that stuff's all fine. It's all right. It's not like what I'm really into musically, but it's good. But what these guys are doing is they're just making original music. They're just also, they're kind of using these sounds. They're piggybacking on them to get, you know, a unique sound for their band. So whoever hired them to do the soundtrack for this game, I think it was a great call. And it brings a whole lot of different things in for me. The drummer pushes it sometimes, the tempo pushes. So it doesn't have that like really quantized. Quantization is like, you know, when an electronic tune is matched perfectly to the grid. So it's just this robotic perfectness. And it doesn't always sound quantized. Like it'll push. The drummer will be doing hits and they're like, gack, gack, gack. You know, they really, it makes you feel like it's falling apart a little bit at times. And it's so energetic. I mean, and then put on top of that, these guys are writing great melodies. I mean, there are some riffs and some melodies in that soundtrack that are just kick ass. I don't know. I'm really in love with it. It and it fits that kind of game too. It's you know, there's this sort of question of what kind of music goes with what kind of game, and you know, not every game is Red Dead Redemption. Not every game is Limbo or something or Flower, and needs some you know, weird experimental interactive soundtrack. And I think like a, you know, River City Ransom beat 'em up certainly doesn't. And so the soundtrack works perfectly with the game. I mean, it would make me want to play all the way through. And there are tons of clips on it, too. That one's great, but there are some other ones, too, that sound like just boss battles from hell. It's really cool stuff.
So. Yeah, it's great.
Do they cross over? Who's their audience? Are they? Do you need to be sort of like 8-bit, 16-bit gamer aware?
Question. The thing, I've listened to some of their stuff outside of the soundtrack. The thing about the soundtrack is that they've got a pretty serious punk sensibility. I mean, their tunes are really short, straight to the point, like melody, simple stuff, and it just rocks out and then they're done. And that, I could see that being a hell of a fun show. I mean, I think they have a ton of material. So I don't know whether they do anything longer than that, but I could see these guys putting on a great show if you were just going to clubs. I think they're out in New York, so I would imagine they play. But I think they also play a lot of like gaming conventions and sort of more oriented that way. I mean, they were a huge hit at PAX. So.
I can only imagine. Yeah, right. It'd be like their dream audience.
Yeah. They were, I mean, of all the bands there was a lot of groups that were okay, but they were really cutting. Yeah. Top.
Yeah. Same happened at PAX East. Actually, they were there as well. And I saw them and they seemed to steal the show.
Yeah. They're a heck of a band. So yeah, I mean, I dig what they're doing and how it doesn't feel like they're just jumping on the 8-bit thing to be cool or like to make some money or, you know, be one of the only bands doing that. Like they're doing it. They're real musicians. Like they're melodists, they're writers, and they're bringing these sounds in just to give their music a unique sound. And it's great stuff. I love the soundtrack to that game. I got to get it. I got to download it. It'll be on sale at some point, I'm sure. I've heard it's, you kind of need to play co-op. So I don't know. I'll wait till I have something to do.
Well, that's Anna Monoguchi. And that was Kirk's selection from Scott Pilgrim. So let's toss it over to you, Dan.
All right. Well, I think I got to go with my selection from the indie game VVVVVV, which is, I guess.
Is that how you pronounce that?
His URL is, I think, the letter V6Tim.es, which I thought was pretty clever. but I assume so, yeah. So anyway, this is I think this is called Pushing Onward, something like that. And it's, yeah, off of that game's original soundtrack. I think it's one of the first levels, if not the very first.
All right, here it is.
Yeah, so that's a fun soundtrack. Obviously, you know, ties in nicely with the Anna Monoguchi stuff. I find the chiptune stuff, or you know, the sort of retro video game sound, really interesting when people do it today. Because I don't know, maybe I shouldn't get into, you know, the cultural thing, because that's not really related. But I just sort of wonder why they're doing it. What I mean by that is it's not trivial to make chiptune music. Like, you have to learn how to use, you know, a tracker maybe, or you have to buy, you know, the real hardware like Anna Monoguchi does. Or you have to learn something like the, you know, the music markup language like I started to do and then quickly abandoned because it was really complicated and kind of tedious. As opposed to, say, you know, if you loaded up GarageBand, it's way more accessible. It's way easier to write music that way. You could have music, you know, fairly quickly. It might not be, you know, the best music in the world, but assuming you're just, you know, some guy, there's a sort of an extra step to go to make chiptune music. Now, if you compare that to just sort of the retro style graphics that you see sometimes, you know, pixel art and that sort of thing, it's sort of the reverse. Like, you know, some people use that because they like the aesthetic, of course, but other people will do it because they're, you know, an indie developer, and it's just way more difficult to, you know, model 3D graphics and animate, you know, 3D characters than it is to make two-dimensional ones. So it's that makes way more sense to me that would be incredibly popular. But I'm really interested, but, you know, I guess it's nostalgia, by why the, you know, there's a continued popularity, and, you know, myself included, I love Anna Monoguchi. There's a continued popularity for this kind of music. So the VVVVVV soundtrack, it has this sort of, I want to say authentic, but that sounds sort of, you know, condescending to the Scott Pilgrim soundtrack, which I also really like.
It's different, though. It definitely sounds different than Scott Pilgrim. It sounds like it was really straight up chiptune. Like, it was
exactly dumb. There's not the mix of a rock band in there,
right? I really hear that in the drumming, man. I like that chiptune drumming where there isn't quite this real drum set. It's more these weird cymbals and stuff that approximate a drum set.
Yeah, it's all
creative, you know. It's just like,
yeah,
going in, like, you don't know what that would ever be in a real band, but it kind of, right. You know, it's cool though. Like, you have to get creative with it to give it the kind of bounce that you want it to have. And that tune has a great bounce.
Yeah, so that one is one of the interesting things about that song, which I don't think really came across in that clip, is that it's very long. Most of the background music you would hear in a you know, like a 16-bit platformer, say. Will be like, you know, maybe around a minute or minute and a half, and it'll loop, right? And there'll be like an A section and a B section, and then they'll alternate, and that's pretty much what you have. Maybe there's, you know, a 5-second intro that you only hear once. But this piece, that the pushing onwards from the V game, it's something like 3 minutes or 4 minutes before it loops, I think. And the little sample I played you, where you have this sort of, you know, cathartic, like, here's the strong melody, here's like the main part, doesn't come in until the song's already been going on for 2 minutes.
So how long is a given level in that game?
The levels can be obscenely long. It's sort of like Super Meat Boy in that you'll die like a billion times trying to do something. Mm-hmm. And you'll just sort of get, you know, reset to the beginning of the little screen you're on. So it can take a very long time to do something. So yeah, I thought it was interesting because it's not arranged the way that, you know, an old chiptune like the original 16-bit stuff would be done. Whereas the Scott Pilgrim stuff is far closer to that, even though, you know, they use the real instruments or whatever, they seem sort of structurally more aligned with quote unquote real video game music, like the oh, stuff, right, you hear in the 90s.
And those Scott Pilgrim tunes are short; they're all really short.
Exactly, really exactly. Also, as I was talking, I was thinking that so Scott Pilgrim versus the World, the game, is a tie-in with the movie, which is based on a comic, which is heavily based on games, yeah, in which the characters are in bands. So I guess they have to sort of cover all their bases by having, you know,
they do,
video
they
game
do
music with real band. Yeah.
So there's like two layers there that I didn't actually think about until you just named them. So, wow, I think I like that move even more now.
Yeah.
So I'm curious because I haven't played the game. There's a very powerful, rhythmic, kind of pulsing, driving thing. I've always wondered about games, particularly those kind of fast-moving 8-bit platformers where the music seems to be driving you on. It must be a tough thing to do compositionally to figure out what you think the player experience should be like. I mean, I'm assuming the game wants to reflect kind of that driving forward thing, but like a slower player, let's say, or people are going to play the game differently,
right?
In all kinds of different ways, and that music somehow must serve the game no matter who's playing it. It must somehow set the tone,
right? Well, as much as I have trouble analyzing it, I think that's one of the largest advantages of a dynamic soundtrack that can respond to what the player is doing. You're not necessarily tied to I believe he's going to go, this quickly through the level, he's going to be punching this often, it should have this kind of feel. If you can reflect what the player has actually done somehow, maybe you can have something that's a little bit more, relevant, I guess. I know that, the Halo soundtracks do that a lot.
Yeah. And that's also only true to a point, of course. I mean, there are games, you can play Super Meat Boy. I guess you can play that in more than one way. Like, you can take your time, I guess. But, you pretty much play that one way. Where when you're playing a game like, Red Dead or GTA, sure, or something like that, it's a much more open-ended experience. So,
yeah, I'm playing the new Donkey Kong Country game, and I've noticed that there are levels that you can't take your time. The level is going on its own speed, and you've got to keep up or you're dead. And the music reflects that. You just get a feeling early on in the level based on how the music is kind of pushing you, and it's familiar stuff, and some of it reminds you of what you've heard before, but it's another example, I think, of how the music can cue you into what the game wants you to do or what you need to do. And maybe it's just me, but it feels to me like I can hear it early on in the level, like, okay, I need to get moving here.
Man, I gotta say, between all the talk of Kirby and Donkey Kong supposed to be great, and then Dan, this Super Mario Galaxy team, you guys are giving me Wii envy. It's like the one console I don't have.
I'm telling you, it's been the last month of gaming for me has been almost all on the Wii, partly because I love the Kirby game so much, but Epic Mickey is well worth playing. I mean, I'm only a little bit into it, and it's got some issues, but there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah, no, it's still a game I'd love to check out.
Yeah.
Yeah, same. I mean, I think, I see the reviews have been sort of lukewarm, but I imagine expectations for that game are off the charts. So how could they not be? Right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a separate subject, but I find and this is true with the Kirby game too, people have this sense that easy is a demerit,
mm-hmm.
right? That if a game fails to be difficult to a certain degree, then it has somehow failed.
Or even difficult in a certain way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so it just seems to me it would be impossible to pitch a game at the place that I think Junction Point's trying to pitch that Epic Mickey game, find that audience that they're looking for, and also please the people who write for GameSpot,
right,
or who read that. It's an impossible task. And you can do things, you can add stuff that's higher up or more difficult to get, or secret things for the hardcore players to work harder to get. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it just feels like you're going to disappoint somebody no matter what you do.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably true.
Yeah. So I'll change things up a little bit, and I'm going to play a piece from the original BioShock. This is from late in the game. The piece is called This Is Where They Sleep. And it's by Gary Scheinman, who's had a pretty big couple of years as a game composer. He wrote the Demon's Souls score, which includes a lot of vocal stuff. He branches off into a slightly different direction there, which is really interesting. You don't get so much of that in the BioShock games, but he did both BioShock games as well. So I'll play this one and we can chat about it.
Hell yeah.
What I love about that, among other things, is how beautifully it conveys the world of Rapture. This metallic kind of sound, this echoey, hard sound, and the way the game, it feels like the music is pulling you forward into a place that you don't want to go, and you're sort of resisting it, and it's not up to you, it's up to the music, and you just have to come with it. And it's got some Bernard Herrmann vibe in it. You know, you can definitely feel some Hitchcock, you know, little tremolo stuff and those little punctuated little string stuff, some psycho-esque, typical horror stuff. But it's the game, I think, has a terrific score that, like we were talking about earlier, often isn't musical. It's often just atmospheric and non-melodic. And then at other times, we probably won't have time for this, but I chose another piece, Eleanor's theme in Bioshock 2. It's deeply melodic and very dark but sweet, and an odd combination of the two. I think he's a very interesting composer. He's very cinematic. He tends to write music that sounds cinematic for games. But I just think his music serves these games so well.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Bioshock's music that I love is that it's a full orchestra recording, which is, you know, not common. I mean, that's not even common in TV anymore. Like, Bear McCreary is, like, one of the only guys doing that. And just that it's, I mean, and it sounds like one. You can hear the space. You can hear people moving their instruments, just even in that clip. Yeah. And it just makes, hearing the space in a game like Bioshock, you know, I mean, that's another game where that, ambient audio is like a soundtrack unto itself. You can just listen to that game and get lost, just standing still in rapture. And it, the way that you can hear the space and the music, yeah, it's totally hot. Plus that violin soloist, that guy, Martin Chalifour is his name. He plays a lot of the solos in Bioshock 2. And I don't think I've heard a game that's really been built around, you know, a violin soloist. I mean, those violin parts from Bioshock they recall the game for me as much as any other part of it. And it's just this one guy, like, just totally killing it. I really love the soundtrack to both Bioshock and Bioshock 2.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was a single guy.
Yeah, he plays that, like, I think he plays the, he plays Eleanor's theme. He does, like, the really crazy violin. It actually got stuck in a loop for me, I think, at one point in, like, Pauper's Drop or something. I was like, this violin music wouldn't stop, so it was like his like crazy violin solo. And, like, it was a bug, I think, but it was a great solo. I mean, it's just like by the 17th time.
It'd be great if the musician got paid extra when it loops
that. Gets royalties. maybe one day, I'm sure he just got a check. That's it. But yeah, you know, something interesting about Bioshock this is kind of related to Fallout is both of those games use an orchestral score, and they use licensed music to kind of conjure a vibe. Like, Bioshock will play those, you know, Beyond the Sea, like, that's like their big song. But there are these other moments in that where a record player starts playing some song and it's super creepy. Mm-hmm. And they do the same kind of thing in Fallout 3 and in New Vegas. And I was actually kind of struck by the differences between the two. I think that actually if we're talking about a lot of stuff we like, I'm not really a fan of the Fallout 3 music. It's the same guy who composed the Dragon Age music. He's done a ton of a guy named Einon Zur. He's done a lot of music, and he's great. I mean, he's a great composer. I just, something about the music in Fallout 3, it's not, yeah, you listen to that track in Bioshock, and it's so, I mean, like you said, it pulls you. It's so compelling. It's so intense and crazy. It's got these weird kind of non-musical screams going on, or like these sort of high frequency squeals. It's really cool stuff. And, so then when there are these moments where, you know, a song starts playing and then maybe the score comes in behind the song and you're not sure who's going to come out of the dark at you, and it's this great moment where it's really easy to play that hand wrong. Like, you can have, you know, like, ain't that a kick in the head? Okay, I don't know. Have you guys played Fallout New Vegas yet?
No,
I have not.
Yeah, well, it's great. It's more Fallout. It's fun. But that song, I mean, it's this just, like, plays constantly in the game. I've probably heard that song, like, there'd be a weekend where I would have listened to it like 18 times or something. Like, it's more times than I've listened to most pieces of music in a year. And it's just I just feel like they completely blew it with the licensed soundtrack. There's like 8 songs on the soundtrack. They play constantly. And then when they're not playing, the soundtrack is also kind of this sort of really overbearing, just cloying, lots of string pads, and the whole thing is kind of a mess. Where in BioShock, you've got this like really potent score coming in. It conjures so many different emotions, and then this licensed music that fits with it so well and gives you this eerie sort of sense of otherness. You know, you're hearing songs you know, but you're in rapture, and it's a kind of alternate reality. And
yeah,
so yeah, I'm just a huge fan of BioShock's music.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, I agree with you. And I think for me, it's the Fallout 3. I think they just try a little too hard to be ironic. The choice is this, you know, I don't want to set the world on fire. You know, then it's like, oh, I get it.
Which is funny, because when you make a song about rapture and it's somewhere beyond the sea, I mean, that's like kind of ironic too. But it works.
It's
like,
different. It's, I think partly because that in terms of the narrative, they were having this big party, you know? And so you get the sense that there's all these, you know, party hats, and that the music is still lingering in the air in a way, and it just makes sense somehow.
Like the record player is just still going.
Yeah, whereas in Fallout 3, it's these radios, you know, kind of.
Well, and it fits with the fiction. And in Fallout 3, like, really, like, if there was a nuclear apocalypse, we wouldn't just listen to the same 8 songs. One thing I liked about the original Fallout 3 was the Abigail quest, where she'll play violin for you, and you find her violin, and then if you do, you get a radio station that's her playing the pieces she knows on violin. I thought that was great, because it tied into the story, and it was very much the kind of thing that we would do, I think, if we were really trying to survive in a, you know, sort of post-apocalyptic world. We'd try to recreate the music of the past, and that would become, it felt so much more valuable than these sort of old recordings that we're playing all the time. So I'd always listen to that. But I don't know, I'm not that far into New Vegas, but there's nothing like that yet. So it's just, ain't that a kick in the head?
So let's see, I guess we're tossing it back to you, Kirk.
Okay. Well, let me think for a second here. I have a few things here. Let's see. Well, we're talking about ambient music. So this is a score that's actually not particularly melodic, or it's actually not really even a score, but definitely one of my favorite games of the year was the downloadable game Limbo. And there's a moment in that game that anyone who plays it knows. I don't really want to spoil it, because just on the off chance that it's going to come to PC, you know, and guys haven't gotten to play it yet. But it's probably like the most harrowing 30 seconds of like my gaming, you know, of the year. And let's play the clip. And anyone who's played the game, I think you'll probably know the part that I'm talking about.
Okay.
And, so here's the clip from the movie. Yeah, so that's it's barely music. There's kind of this heartbeat going, which is a theme in the game. You know, you feel the little boy's heartbeat almost. It feels that way through the rumble pack as you move around. You're this, you know, little boy moving around this mysterious black and white world who's very vulnerable, and you feel his vulnerability in your hand already. Anytime he moves or lands on something, there's this little pulse that goes through your controller. So this heartbeat kind of starts up. And then there's just this sort of undulating drone underneath it, and it builds, and it just feels kind of heavy and thick. And combined with the game's visuals, I mean, it's this moment. I mean, there's a spider involved. I'll leave it at that. It's a moment that's so it was so affecting. I was like screaming at my screen. I was so freaked out. It's so oppressive and just minimal. That whole game is so minimal. I thought it was really cool. You know, as again, as much as I'm a huge fan of melody, as a musician, as a listener, and as a gamer, I think that kind of thing, like the kind of music in Silent Hill, a lot of really good horror games get it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, and if you're gonna design a game that's as dark as that, I mean, literally visually as dark as that game is, you need sound cues to help the player.
Well, right. And they're really good. You know, I was actually playing through the puzzle to get to that, to record that audio. And just still noticing things. There's the puzzle right before that where there's these spider legs you have to trick the spider into putting its legs into this trap. But first you have to get the spider legs to knock the trap off of a tree that's off screen. But you can hear it every time the spider leg hits the ground. You hear this clank as the trap moves towards falling. But you have to really pay attention to all of those cues to play the game. It's a really well-integrated game. That's a brilliant game.
I mean, I don't think we often realize how small these teams are. And when games look really good, you know, you play a game that's made by four people and it looks tremendous, and you just finished playing a game that was made by 40 people or 100 people, you know, you don't necessarily realize. I remember when a few years ago when I met Vince Diamante, this was shortly after Flower had come out, and he was taking pictures at GDC. He was hired by them to take just photographs and kind of documenting GDC and getting just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photographs of all the talks and everything. And I was just chatting with him, really sweet guy. And I discovered that he wrote the music for Flower.
Oh, really?
He wrote all of it. By himself.
God.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I at that point was still enraptured by the game. I mean, just the mention of it made me just, you know, I float a little bit above the ground. And I just it struck me at that moment, my God, you know, that game, this guy standing in front of me did the whole damn thing.
Yeah, that's amazing when that happens.
Yeah.
And it's usually, I feel like with the smaller games, what you get out of it is, I mean, I don't know. I know I've got some friends from music school and stuff who are down in LA doing film scoring and TV stuff. And, you know, so often you'll see, and, you know, I honestly take this with a grain of salt. I don't work in the industry, but you'll see a composer's name. Like, you'll see John Williams' name on a score or whoever, you know, someone like him, a big name composer. But, you know, there it's farmed out to a whole ton of guys who do a lot of the cues and a lot of the orchestration. And it's a big team effort to get something like that done and get all the cues to match up. And sometimes you can kind of lose a little bit of the artistic focus, where with a small game, you know, like a game like Flower, that was clearly the work of one musician. I mean, that was someone who like had a really specific thing to say, and he said it really well. I mean, he worked with the team to say it through gameplay as well. So it was this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I should mention he did work with a sound designer, so you know the very specific sounds of the grass, for example. That's he was working with another person for that. But in terms of the music, the compositions, have you ever thought about composing for games? Is it something that would interest you ever?
Sure. I don't know if I really have the chops for it yet. But I would love to try. You know, I'm sort of on one of those guys in the periphery where I'm not a great musician or a great composer or anything like that. I just sort of really, really like music theory. But it's something that I could do one day, then absolutely.
Yeah.
Who doesn't like music theory?
Well, you'd be surprised.
All right. So we'll move right along back over to you, Dan.
All right. Well, we were talking, Kirk, you mentioned that we weren't talking very much about soundtracks that we don't like. Maybe I should play one of those, since I did pick out one piece in particular that just sort of, I'll just play it. This is from Sonic the Hedgehog 4, which, you know, the DLC release this year. From what I understand, this is the first act of the game, Splash Hill Zone Act 1.
All right.
Yeah, so I should start by saying that when I was very little, when I was, I guess, 4 or something like that, I started playing Sega, you know, console video games. I had a Master System, and then I had a Genesis, and that was sort of where I cut my teeth. And I like loved the 2D Sonic games, Sonic, you know, 1 through 3, Sonic and Knuckles. Those are my favorite games going off. Those are the first games that I, you know, really dug into, the first games that I finished. And are, you know, at least partially responsible for me, you know, sort of directing myself towards music, because I always loved the music in those games. And, you know, sometimes I'll write about them on my website and whatever. So when I heard that they were making a Sonic the Hedgehog 4, I was, you know, I was excited because, you know, more 2D Sonic. Maybe they're finally realizing, you know, what Sega fans want. You know, they don't want this cast of ridiculous characters and, the, you know, whatever. I'm sure you've heard all those complaints before, but I was also excited to hear, you know, what they were going to do with the music, because I assumed they were going to go back to sort of, you know, good Sonic music as opposed to a lot of the stuff in, you know, even starting with Sonic Adventure, which I still thought was pretty good. There, you know, they brought in the rock guitars and the little squeals and the dives, and it didn't do it for me. So I was hoping for a return to form, I guess. And when they released this clip ahead of the game's release as, you know, some sort of promotional thing, and I was sort of banging my head on the desk that it seems like they got it all wrong to me. They clearly realized that they needed to, like, sort of ape the style of the older Sonic games. Like, you can, that snare sound is like that little, you know, pop is like, that's straight out of the Genesis. And, like, you know, you can hear the influence, the little, the contour of the melody.
That snare sounds totally out of place. That was like my one takeaway. Yeah. Isn't it like, sucks.
Doesn't it?
It's terrible. It's just like, snare.
It's like they wrote the piece and then they're like, oh, right, it has to sound like the Genesis.
Forget our big, huge sounding awesome snare. Like, let's put this crappy snare.
Right. It doesn't like jive with what they did with the rest of the piece. And like they stole the, you know, the contour of the melody is like, out of like a Sonic 2 level select, I guess, that so that, you know, that's sort of derivative, but I just none of the pieces really, you know, the whole was less than the sum of its parts somehow. It's like you can hear where they took all these influences were, with like that really thick synthesizer and the snare that we mentioned and the melody, and they ended this like ridiculous, like fast driving beat to it, and it sounds like, you know, an amateur remix of a Sonic song. Like, there's nothing about that appeals to me in the way that the original songs did. It's not harmonically interesting. The melody is ridiculous. I don't know. I was really angry when I heard that. And it actually literally turned me off to the game. And I still, you know, I gave it a chance and I played the demo, and they had messed with the physics a little bit too much for my liking, and that was the end of it. But I that was like one of the most visceral reactions to a piece of game music that probably I've ever had. And it was unfortunately a negative one.
It's funny how like uninspiredness can inspire such a visceral reaction. It's just really uninspired sounding. It's just there it is.
Yeah, where did it all go wrong? It's just mind-boggling how you can mess that series up as badly as they've messed it up.
Yeah, it's almost like they're messing with us.
It's all a big joke.
And closer. And then,
there's going to be this huge reveal in like 15 years.
Well, you know, the thing about ownership, that fan ownership, you have a sense of that from going way back, is that it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, you've just proved it. I mean, it sometimes with the Zelda, I hear it and I just melt. And if it's good, I want to play it. And if it's crap, then it just makes you mad.
Yeah.
Well, you want to do one more each? Does that appeal?
That sounds great.
Okay, so you guys can't get out of here without me playing some Kirby.
All right.
So let's play some Kirby's Epic Yarn. This is from early in the game. This is the first kind of full level that you play after you're introduced to that post-tutorial part of the game. This is called Fountain Gardens in Kirby's Epic Yarn. So I think there's a thin line between charming and cloying, and
yeah.
Kirby gets it on the charming side almost every time in this game. There might be a few times when they step over that line, but this song could have gone so wrong. I think it's got that wonderful childlike wonder. It always, when I hear this, it does what the game needs to do at that time. It's that moment when Dorothy opens the door into the Technicolor world. It's the moment when you enter the game and you're sort of like, oh, it's going to be like this, you know? And my unabashed love of this game is just, you know, all-consuming. And part of it's because of the music. The music so reinforces the experience in these lovely ways. It's more complicated than you think it is if you pay attention to it. It doesn't do a lot of looping, you know, after like 16 bars. There's more to say usually in each piece. And it feels like a world that you want to be in. And of course it changes and the music changes as the levels change, and it's not cookie cutter stuff. It's a pretty wide palette of musical styles in the game. But I think this particular piece is kind of a signature Kirby tune for this game. It's so bright and welcoming and magical to me.
I was imagining like the opening credits to a cartoon, you know?
Yeah.
I remember listening to I went through that awesome post you wrote, by the way, about the music of this game, putting it sort of in order. What was interesting about this piece is that it's not the first piece of the game, right? It's like when the level sort of opens up and it has that feeling like the orchestra is introduced for the first time. Like
yes.
The orchestra, you know, in Scarecrow, like it's not an orchestra.
Yeah, initially it's just piano. All you hear is just a very simple piano early on.
That's interesting.
That's cool. Like it feels so... Yeah, the melody is really familiar feeling. Like there's even like a little bibbity bobbity boo in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this, you really know where it's going. Like you're not going to get surprised by some crazy ass false cadence or something. Like it's going to resolve to one. Like we're in safe territory here. Which, you know, all the later music in the game isn't all really like that. But it's so, yeah, it has a great motion to it. The thing it's cool how these Nintendo games get away with not trying to approximate real instruments. It's a whole trick to do that. Like, you know, like Logic now, you can make a soundtrack that sounds real that isn't. But they don't, you know, they don't go there. It's almost like an Uncanny Valley thing. Like they get there. There's such a performance quality to that music, but it's more in like the groove of it than the tone. Like the sounds of, you know, there's like kind of this English horn or oboe thing playing the melody. But it's, you know, the tone of it is whatever. But the rhythm, the way the rhythms move is great. Like it's so bouncy. I dig it.
Yeah, now I'm not a longtime Kirby fan or anything. Can you guys maybe help me out? Are those like established Kirby themes that they're playing on there, or is this sort of a new piece?
It's the game is full of references and restatements of Kirby themes. Yeah, but there's a lot of new music in it, and because the game has this primitive quality to it, you know, how the visual style is this, you know, fabrics and textiles and buttons and strings and yarn. They've pared the music down to sometimes very simple stuff. Some of the busiest tunes are just played on a piano, and they change the piano. So occasionally it's this kind of tinny piano that you hear. And other times it's, you know, feels like, you know, a Steinway sort of piano, a richer, deeper feeling. So they even play with the quality or the timbre of the sounds. But I think Kirby fans will recognize motifs clearly, but I don't find that it doesn't appeal to me like the Zelda games do, where you kind of wait for that tune or that tune, and it's, you get the lovely little moments where you discover the treasure and you get the little sound. This seems to me to be a pretty ambitious reboot of the series. And I think that's partly because they handed it off to this Good Feel developer that really did reboot the game, the gameplay, the visuals, everything. So it seems appropriate that the music is kind of rebooted as well.
Right.
It's interesting. I'm noticing a lot of the games we picked, and I think a lot of the games that people choose as their favorite soundtracks are games with no talking. A lot of platformers and a lot of older role-playing games. And you definitely like music like that Kirby music. It really comes out in a game like a platformer where there's this really strong melody that's being stated. And if you had someone talking over that, or even like battle chatter going on over that, it would get too busy. And it's cool that those types of games really allow that to come out, and that kind of music. I've noticed, I think part of the reason that we don't always hear music like that in these super next-gen-y games, you know, that are like really cinematic, is because there's so much talking going on that we're kind of the same part of our mind that we use to listen to melody we kind of use to listen to words. I don't know what it is exactly.
I think it's a really good point.
Yeah, like in the like in Final Fantasy 13 compared to like an older Final Fantasy game, like Final Fantasy 7. Like the music in Final Fantasy 7, and I think it was on Experience Points. There was a great post that Scott wrote about this, about how that game's music was such a part of the experience. You know, you really felt it. And then, you know, compared to 13, where it was like, I really enjoyed the soundtrack to that game, but there was a lot of singing going on and it got lost in the background because there's all this talking going on too. And there was sort of too much happening in my melodic space to really, to hear it. But in a game like Kirby, you know, that really simple song can just come out and be right at the fore. It's pretty cool. Huh.
Well, Mr. Let's see, I guess it's your turn, Kirk. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to play one more. Well, this gets I got a lot, but I'll choose one. Because I know there's one. I know, Dan, there's a game that you played this year, too. And it also brings up a kind of interesting question of, which I think we've talked about a little bit, too, is sort of sequels and bringing the music back. And it's sort of one question when you're rebooting a sequel on a next-gen hardware, you know, that it's a game from, like, you know, 15 years ago. But this game, so my music is from Mass Effect, from the original. And it was, I think, my favorite piece. I loved the soundtrack to the first Mass Effect so much. And I think this was my favorite piece of music. And when I got the sequel, which I really loved that game as well, but I didn't like the soundtrack quite as much. But there was a moment where there were so many, you know, just you can carry your save over from the past game. There's so much tribute to Mass Effect 1 in Mass Effect 2. That the first moment where you go to the map in Mass Effect 2, and I thought, okay, well, this is the litmus test. If they get this music right, and they saved the music from the first game, which is the best music from the game, then they know what they're doing. And so I boot up the map, and this music starts playing, and I knew that they knew what they were doing. So here's the map music. It's the map music from Mass Effect 1. So that music, to me anyway, I love it. I love the theme that comes in. I love the way that it, you know, you hear this sound as you go into the map and then the music comes up and then that flute melody comes in and it's just, it really goes to this epic place that you kind of hear it going and then the chord finally changes and it's so cool. And there are a lot of themes in the first Mass Effect that are that way. The music that plays over the title, when you just boot it up and leave the title menu on, that music as well. And when you die in that game, that's another one of my favorite death scenes. It's like this Tron, like, kind of thing plays.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Killer soundtrack in that game. I mean, just totally conjured what they were going for. And then interestingly, in the sequel, the best stuff in the sequel is the music from the first game. And they kind of replace a lot of it with orchestral stuff. I think it's the same composer, but there's a lot more... there's a lot more just sort of full bombastic, the stuff you'd expect to see in a movie. And I think part of that goes with, you know, Mass Effect 2 is much more just like this interactive movie, where the first one was a little, you know, a little weirder and a little more idiosyncratic as a game. But it's interesting. I've been looking a lot at the sequels from this generation and how they're dealing with their soundtracks. And it's been kind of all over the place. Like, I mean, you've got, okay, so... I think the music in Fallout New Vegas is the same as the music in Fallout 3. And both, I think, are kind of lackluster. So it's like, great, the same soundtrack again. And Fable 3 is another game that, like, I liked the soundtrack in Fable 2. It, like, really captured the vibe of the game. But then it's the exact same music in Fable 3. And we're 2 years later now. That kind of bummed me out. I was expecting something new, like Danny Elfman's score from the first Fable or something. And then, like, Assassin's Creed 2 changed its music with Brotherhood and got rid of some of the sort of romantic themes that I like, but they replaced it with some pretty cool stuff. These, like, really some weird, like, these more like really these deep organs and this crazy like singing. And yeah, it's been interesting to see how, you know, a composer who made a game 2 years ago then has to make new music for his, you know, for the sequel to the game, since everything is a sequel right now. And just to see what we're getting. Sometimes it's totally recycled. Sometimes it's totally redone. And then, you know, like in the case of Mass Effect, it's not really quite as strong, actually, as the original game.
Yeah, I had the same response, actually, to the Mass Effect 2 score. And I was thinking as you were talking, Kirk, I don't think I could, like, sing you right now any piece from Mass Effect 2 if it was not in Mass Effect 1.
You know, I feel urgent. Like, but that's about it.
Yeah. But like that map theme is like so iconic. Like, and I guess the title screen music also. But
and it's funny, you know,
that's what I remember.
You know? In those sequels, there will be these moments. There's a moment in Mass Effect 2 where you run into Ashley or Caden or whoever. You know, mm-hmm. your former flame, and in that moment, it starts playing that like one of the other themes, the title music from Mass Effect, and it hits you. You know, it hits you so hard. You're like, oh, this person from Mass Effect 1. It's this total recall to your memories with them and whatever. And like, but it's also kind of, I'm more affected by this music from the last game than I've been by anything that's played, you know, over the
right.
last many hours.
And like, it's perfectly functional, you know, like the tense music sure. is tense and whatever, but like, it doesn't stand out, I guess. It just, yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't have that inspiration. And sometimes in Assassin's Creed 2 or Brotherhood, the same thing will happen though. In Brotherhood, they'll, you know, a character will come on and it'll play like Ezio's original theme. It's this really driving, almost kind of cheesy, but I like it, but like but theme. And then I remember I'm so taken back to the last game, and I wonder if in the next Assassin's Creed or the next Mass Effect they'll play some music from the second one, you know, and we'll have the same mm-hmm. feeling. I kind of doubt it, but you never know.
They'll have to call back to one again, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that whole thing where sometimes I wonder about some of these game themes, you know, like a lot of them are really great compositions, but sometimes I hear them and it's just so much more about my memory playing the game and
yeah.
that time in my life.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That it's so difficult to take the two apart. I mean, when I played Mass Effect, I just loved Mass Effect. So when I hear music from Mass Effect, I just think happy thoughts. And
but isn't that great though? I mean, that's really you started playing that music and I automatically started thinking, what planet do I want to go to?
Yeah, it totally mm-hmm. is this like endless possibility. And here's your, yeah. you know, you're going to go to some really repetitive, like copy pasted planet and drive around for
like,
<it's
awesome. laughs> Yeah. The dog tiger.
But at the moment when you go into the thing, yeah, no, it feels so great.
Yeah.
You guys are probably too young to remember Tangerine Dream. You know, does it ring any bells with you? Tangerine Dream?
Absolutely not.
So Tangerine Dream was, they composed the music for a movie called Risky Business, which was a Tom Cruise
movie. Yeah, they were a band, right?
Yeah, they were a band. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Electronic band.
I mean, I've heard it as a band, but yeah. I don't
know. It's very much, you should go watch Risky Business and see if the Mass Effect score doesn't connect.
Man, you know, I just heard the Daft Punk soundtrack for the new Tron movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy wow, it's sick. It's like it's really great, and they should score Mass Effect 3. I mean, yeah. Like, it's the minute I heard it, I was like, oh dude, like
part of it is that the second one, it felt the synths, they didn't deal with the synths in the same way, and it didn't feel as ethereal. Like there's this wonderful kind of spacey ethereal quality that the first one had that the second one seemed to be a little bit more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, if to my ear anyway. It felt like they didn't want it to be quite as fakey sounding, sort of beautiful electronic sounding. They wanted to root it somehow a little bit differently. I don't know.
Yeah, it was a puzzling choice.
Yeah.
I guess the game itself sort of did that as well. You know, it's less about they're exploring open planets or whatever. It's more like sort of compartmentalized missions.
That's a good point.
And a little less new, you know. The first one, it just felt so new. And with that music too, it was like, man, like I haven't heard a soundtrack like this for a game in a long time. And the whole thing just felt like this new world, where the sequel it felt a lot more familiar, not only because it was a sequel, but also because a lot of the, you know, the situations and the writing and the story were just much more familiar feeling.
Well, it does make you consider the kind of curse that you face when you do a sequel, either as a game designer or as a composer or whatever, just the difficulty of getting out from underneath that shadow and finding your own way.
And then I guess my question is whether you really have to. I mean, I guess you do. Like, you want to do something new. But also, like, the, yeah, it's a exactly. It's a tricky balance, I guess, between keeping what worked and, you know, striking out in a new direction.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, that's a really interesting moment in a lot of games, particularly RPGs, I guess, where there's sort of, after the little introductory segment, maybe the first dungeon if you're in, like, a Zelda-type game, there's this moment where the world sort of opens up to you and you sort of get the sense of possibility.
Oh, man, Bethesda's yeah, I've really good written about that, yeah, that moment.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, thinking about the musical cues that happen when you're faced with that is kind of interesting. So Mass Effect, I think, does it pretty well because you're sort of overwhelmed, right? You're looking at, like, a galaxy. Or, you know, Ocarina of Time does it with, like, this, you know, little simulated orchestra flourish thing. You first look at Hyrule Field. Or, like, a game like Oblivion, I believe it's nothing. I think you come out of the was it the dungeon or the escape path from the dungeon?
Rat-infested sewer.
Yeah. Exactly, sewer. That's right, that's right. And you just sort of, you come out on, like, a hillside and you just hear, like, birds chirping. Yeah. The music doesn't even start right away.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, the Mass Effect thing is really minimal. It doesn't, it's not like, ta-da, the universe.
Exactly,
like, it doesn't
exactly.
have that feeling. It's like, here you go, buddy, you're going to be fine. Like, it kind of makes me feel good, which is nice.
Right.
I wonder if, I mean, I'm sure they, you know, they talked to the composer, in any of those games, to the composers, but that, like, whether a composer really understands that moment seems like it would be important to really think about it. Because that moment, man, when the world opens up, like, that's one of my favorite moments in any game.
Well, maybe the trick is that you handing it off to someone else to see what they'd like to do with it isn't always a bad thing. I mean, I certainly think with BioShock 2, a lot of people were skeptical about that. Well, and Minerva's Den is a great example too. If people have played that, it's just, you know, what if you understand the world and the universe really well, and you have a good sense of how it works, let someone else take that. You know, like if they really do understand it, let them have it and see what they might make of it and let them play with it a little bit. And some amazing things can happen.
Well, and sort of like what Anamanaguchi does, you know, with like chiptune sounds is a similar deal. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Well, Mr. Bruno, why don't you bring us home?
I think I'll have to go with my selection from Super Mario Galaxy 2.
Yay.
Which is actually the theme song from Super Mario 64.
All right, so here it comes.
Man, I love that piece.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
So this is the way you're supposed to remake an old theme song if you're going to do that. So they sort of, it's hard to even hear in your mind what the old one sounds like after that. But the melody was done by this sort of weird, like, talky sounding synth. And they sort of really, for Mario Galaxy 2, they really played up the big band arrangement. You know, they got rid of those little, like, wimpy Nintendo 64 patches. And it's so, like, I mean, that's the, I don't think, you know, spoilers really apply that much to Mario games, I guess, but that is from, you know, a level that's actually just sort of ripped wholesale from Mario 64. And they called it the Throwback Galaxy, and they threw the old music on it. And it was just like direct play for, you know, nostalgic, you know, oh my God, it's that level. And that's just such a great song. I know we just, we played Super Mario 64 with the Vintage Game Club. I guess it was 2 months ago now, a month or two ago. David Carlton and I were talking about how much we love that piece. It's just something about it just really gets its hooks into us. One thing that I meant to talk about and never got a chance to was how that's actually the basis for, you know, the other pieces in Super Mario 64, at least some of them, you know, the slide piece, the sort of snowy, wintry piece are actually all really the same song. Just, you know, they sort of tweak the melody a little bit. They have the same structure, the same harmonic content as that one. So it's sort of done the same way that, you know, Super Mario World was done with the one main theme that the other, you know, other levels are sort of based around that. In any case, I guess that's not really representative of this, but I felt the same way about Galaxy 1 versus 2 as I did about Mass Effect 1 versus 2 with regards to the score. I thought that the melodies in Galaxy 2 were significantly weaker, and the score sort of suffered from, like, it sounded like the B-sides essentially to Mario Galaxy, like things that they might have composed and then discarded in favor of the songs that were better. So we got all of the songs that were, like, not quite as good, even though they were in the same style.
The best song in the game is from Mario 64. So, yeah.
Oh yeah. Which was missing entirely from Galaxy 1. Right. So that, yeah. But I think that's sort of true in general, and that all the best songs in Galaxy 2 are the ones that are, you know, oh, this is the Ghost House theme from Mario World. Or this is, you know, they have the remix of World 1-1 again from Mario Brothers, and they have the slide music from Mario 64. So I feel like there are more of those little throwback songs, and they thought they were generally well done, but the new original music didn't really do it for me in the same way. I'm not really sure why that is.
Did you feel the same way about the level design and the game itself in 2, or just mostly the music that didn't live up to the first?
It's hard to say. I think it's part of it was, you know, there's a novelty factor to Mario Galaxy 1. I think I probably would say I preferred the first one. And, you know, just speaking purely from gameplay, but not necessarily because the second one was, you know, derivative or they ran out of ideas or anything. If anything, they, you know, they had too many ideas in Galaxy 2. You're doing a new thing every level. But I thought, you know, I thought the level design was overall pretty solid. It just, I don't think it hooked me as strongly because it, you know, sort of was definitionally more of the same.
It's cool with that, you know, on the music, that kind of a remake seems not that common to me. Like to hear, that was a full on, you know, big band playing this like jazzy, funky version of something that had originally been recorded, you know, as a chiptune. Where, you know, we're hearing a lot in the opposite direction. There's been this kind of 8-bit fad over the last year. You'll hear the Dark Side of the Moon done, you know, in 8-bit mm-hmm. or whatever album, you know, and that kind those sounds. Yeah, right. Yeah, I heard that. God. Yeah. Which, you know, no comment. It was cool, I guess.
Yeah. No, it was.
But, you know, I mean, it was totally cool. It was clearly a labor of love. Same with Dark Side of the Moon. You know, I mean, it was impressive that they did it. What's cool, it's cool to hear it the other way around. I mean, I've done some of that myself, like to take music from a game that's really simple and then reorchestrate it for real instruments. Mm-hmm. And approach it that way. I mean, that's a killing arrangement of that. C4 theme. I mean, they're killing it, and it really it works. It wouldn't work for every tune, you know. And I'm sure there are plenty of bands out there that do that. We interviewed a guy on Melodico who has a band where they'll play live versions of the chip tunes while like a dude plays through like Ninja Gaiden on a giant screen behind them.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's intense. I wouldn't want to be that guy.
Well, we should mention, I'll put a link up for this, if you don't mind, Kirk. You have a band, and you actually have your own version of a song, Maya Faye's theme.
Oh, yeah, that's the, the first thing I ever did. That was really just me. I just recorded a bunch of instruments in my room.
Oh, okay, but that's from Phoenix Wright, if people
yeah,
are familiar.
Yeah, from Phoenix Wright. Mm-hmm. I love the music from that.
Should we put that up so people can take a listen
yeah,
to that?
Yeah, oh, that would be great. Yeah, okay, I made it like YouTube homage and everything. And that experience, that was cool doing that tune. It made me really want to do it more. I think when I have more time, I probably will.
Yeah.
To take real instruments, shakers and clarinets and flutes and guitars and, you know, mallet instruments, and then kind of reimagine the original recording on these new instruments. And that, I mean, that Mario recording totally does that. I like loved that. I went and listened to the whole thing. It was, I would just go see a big band just play Mario music. Like,
there's a CD of that actually. Of a band
there
that, yeah.
I guess that, yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I got to check it out.
I should have mentioned this earlier, I guess, but being a, you know, a guy who likes these, you know, strongly melodic video game pieces, you know, in the traditional sense of, you know, oh, there's the, you know, the loop and everything like that. One of the most interesting soundtracks that I've ever heard is actually for Super Smash Brothers Brawl. Because it's like a library or a museum of, you know, famous game themes.
Yeah, I remember that, analysis you did of the Mario, the original Mario theme on that. It was, yeah, really cool.
Yeah. And like there's a ton of them that are, done, you know, sort of similar to this Galaxy 2 one. I think there's one of the Zelda theme where it's done up with a full orchestra. Well, I find that kind of stuff really interesting. And it's just from a historical perspective too. Like, you know, there's tons of games that I don't play a lot of video games like, you know, I probably should. I tend to, you know, dig into my yes. few video games that I have. But so it's just to be exposed to that much, you know, famous game music is really interesting. And then to see, you know, there's like a some sort of update of like a Sonic the Hedgehog song with, you know, with the electric guitars and stuff like they used in Sonic Adventure. But it's pretty well done. Like they kept the spirit of the original piece. So yeah, that's definitely like something I should probably look more closely at for.
It's that intangible thing, you know, like how do you capture the music, change it, but not screw it up, you know, like that's the challenge. And I don't know the answer, but it's interesting.
I was hoping we would answer that right now.
Oh, right. Sorry. I forgot. That was like the idea here. We're supposed to come up with an answer. How okay, cool. Maybe next time.
All right.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much for your time. This has been a wonderful conversation from my point of view. I hope the listeners find it interesting. This is exactly what I wanted, which was a nice chat with a couple of people who know way more about this stuff than me. And I mean, let's face it, you know, it's just fun to listen to this music. We don't have to be interesting. The music is interesting. So
right, let it do the heavy lifting.
You know, I think I'll, if you don't mind, guys, I'll just mention before we hang it up here, you were very kind in coming up with a bunch of different suggestions for me. We can't get to all of them, but I'll just quickly mention the ones we kind of left on the table. Kirk was interested in Flower as well, some gameplay stuff there, and Phoenix Wright, we mentioned some really cool stuff there, some music from Plants vs. Zombies.
I should say that soundtrack just kills me. I bought it off of from Laura Shigehara, just straight from Bandcamp, and I really recommend checking it out.
Okay.
She's got these full band versions of it. It's a great soundtrack to that game.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, as long as we're talking about this stuff, we might as well let people know everything we thought of. Monkey Island, the intro piece.
Probably my favorite single piece of game music.
it's so memorable, too. Just listen to it and you're in a good mood for the rest of the day.
Agree.
Final Fantasy Tactics, some battle music in there that you like. And Dan had a few others, some Warcraft 2 music, The Dance of the Ogre. And you know, in general, Blizzard's older games, you mentioned, Dan, have some great melodies in them.
Yes, I've been thinking about what you said, Kirk, about how games without talking tend to have music like that, and that seems to that's pretty spot on. I think that seems to be the music that I'm most interested in. Yeah,
and you mentioned also Arisenal, T for Two.
Yeah, I assume that's how you say it.
I'm not sure either. Yeah.
So there's this guy. I guess his name is Ferry Hollim, who makes these little flash games, and on this, you know, it's like ferryhollim.com/Arisenal. Which is like original with an S, and they're fantastic. They're very small and simple, and they usually, you know, it's like mouse, maybe one or two buttons, or, you know, whatever. They all have really, really good music. It doesn't seem to be a super popular site. I don't really remember how I first came across it. It's been around for like, I don't know, probably since like 2002 or something like that. It's forever in internet years. But yeah, there's just like maybe a dozen or two, maybe three of these little tiny flash games, and they sound great. I really recommend them.
Cool. I will link to them in the show notes. And then I had a couple of others. Kind of an obvious one for me, Nate's theme from Uncharted 2, which is just, you know, kind of cinematic, full-out Hollywood music applied to a game. And then a little sort of personal choice for me and Lee Alexander, and that would be Persona 3. Various pieces in that, but if game music can kind of define the spirit of a game, this J-pop sound of the Persona 3 and 4 games are just perfect and like bubblegum stuff that it just says Persona 3 to me. And the World Ends With You, which has some similar kind of stuff, that just evokes the world of the game to me.
Gotta make me get a PlayStation or something.
Just get World Ends With You on DS, man. That's all you need.
I think I have that, actually. I just haven't played it yet.
Oh, check it out. It's a killer soundtrack. It's similar to Persona in a lot of ways, actually.
Yeah, and it's a fun game, too.
Weird. It'll break your brain trying to play
it. Totally will. Yeah.
Bring it on.
Well, gentlemen, thanks very, very much. And I really appreciate your time and your expertise and all of your suggestions. And I hope that maybe we shed a little bit of light tonight. And, you know, let's encourage people to listen a little bit more carefully to game music, because there's a lot to listen to.
Yeah, there is. It was a total pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yes, and, same here.
Gentlemen, take care, and we'll have you back on again soon, I hope.
Cheers. Okay.
We'll love it.
All right. Take care.